today, a searing indictment of Donald Trump's presidency by his former national security advisor. But what is John Bolton's motivation? Jonathan Friedland, you've covered American politics for a long time. You've read 600 pages of John Bolton's book about Donald Trump. What did you take away from it?
What I take away is that John Bolton is pretty angry, furious at his own exile from power. He's also provided an upfront, close-up and personal depiction of the court of Donald Trump and of Donald Trump himself. And the Donald Trump, as seen by John Bolton, who was in the room, is almost comically ignorant. He thinks Finland is part of Russia. He doesn't know that the United Kingdom is a nuclear power. He is incompetent. The White House under him is chaos incarnate. And he is a man who is capable of acts that are fairly described as wicked. He wants to put America's national interest second to whatever is his own personal interest in terms of his political standing and even the fate and fortune of his own family. He is prepared to do anything to compromise and sell out any American value for his own advancement. And this time, in the pages of this book, it's not a Democrat saying it, it's not an anonymous source saying it, it's not a journalist saying it. It's an absolute insider in the Oval Office saying it, a card-carrying conviction Republican saying it. It is a damning indictment of Donald Trump.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how damaging is John Bolton's scathing account of Donald Trump's White House? Tell us about John Bolton becoming National Security Advisor.
John Bolton has been a permanent fixture in Republican and ultra-conservative politics, going really back to the 1980s. He worked at a fairly low level in the Ronald Reagan administration and then for George Bush Sr. His reputation is particularly as an uber hawk.
I don't think there's any question that the decision to overthrow Saddam Hussein was the correct decision.
I think the only secure route to preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons is to change the regime in Tehran.
He's a very distinct figure with this walrus-like moustache. He has a take-no-prisoners rhetorical style.
The only question to the United States is what's in our national interest. And if you don't like that, I'm sorry, but that is the fact.
And so he was somebody who has always been on the Rolodex for any incoming Republican president, and he'd been more or less auditioning for the role. He went on Fox News and said nice things about Trump.
He would have been a good trial lawyer. He'd keep those witnesses moving along. He understands the threat of nuclear proliferation from the likes of Iran and North Korea, and he's determined to prevent it on his watch.
So he was brought in as Donald Trump's third national security advisor.
I think he's going to be a fantastic representative of our team. He's highly respected by everybody in this room.
We know that Trump burns through personnel. And for many people, this was a shock because one thing we knew about Trump was that he was an isolationist and didn't want big foreign wars anymore. And yet what gets Bolton out of bed in the morning is the notion of finding a country and hoping to topple its government or make war against it. So this was always going to be an odd couple. But he came in as national security advisor. It's an odd role. You have to corral the defense secretary, the secretary of state, the president himself. And for well over a year, he was an absolutely significant advisor to Donald Trump, who would meet with him daily, twice daily, three times daily. And as the title of the book suggests, he was in the room where it happened. And that's significant in terms of this book, because it means that unlike, say, Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury or the various anonymous accounts that have appeared, it's the highest level memoir so far to appear, and therefore that gives his claims about Donald Trump huge credibility.
Why would someone who was such a foreign policy hawk want to join Trump's administration?
I think coming through the book is the sense of a Faustian bargain that he believed he would, yes, compromise in a way by working for this man who believes things he didn't believe, but he would get his way on some things. And I think, for example, it was religion for John Bolton for America to break out of the Iran nuclear deal.
The deal was a scam to begin with that the Iranians perpetrated with Obama's willing assistance.
And I think he thought, I'll go along with Trump on lots of other things simply so I can achieve that objective of undoing Barack Obama's nuclear deal and getting the United States out. And that for him was a huge prize. So I think he went in some ways quite clear-eyed that this was a deal with the devil. But even he, as the book goes on, you can tell he's quite shocked by quite how devilish the devil is.
Okay, so John Bolton lasted just 17 months, although actually that's not bad for the Trump administration. Leaving the role as National Security Advisor last September, he now claims that the president was totally driven by self-interest. What does he say that looked like?
All the way through, the only person Donald Trump is ever thinking about is Donald Trump. And in a way, you could say, look, all politicians are thinking about their survival and re-election. With John Bolton's version of Donald Trump, it goes much further than that. He is prepared to subordinate and just trample over long-standing American positions, American values, just to gain an advantage, if not even necessarily in terms of re-election, but for the advancement of his own family. So just one example. After the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi has been murdered and brutally murdered in a Saudi consulate, and all fingers of blame seem to point to the leader of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and it falls to the United States to make a decision and make a statement about this. Not only does Donald Trump go way further than his advisors and give unqualified support to the Saudi leader without any caveats or nuance, which has some advisors, including Bolton, worried, but he then suggests, why don't I read out this statement myself? In other words, why don't I associate the presidency of the United States directly with endorsement for a brutal assassination of a political rival by the Saudis?
They have nothing definitive. And the fact is, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. We are with Saudi Arabia. We're staying with Saudi Arabia. And by the way, just so everybody, I have no business whatsoever with Saudi Arabia. Couldn't care less.
And his motive for doing it isn't some notion about American strategy in the Gulf or foreign policy, but he thinks if he's on camera reading this statement, that will distract attention from another rising scandal, which has the potential to incriminate his family, namely revelations that his daughter, Ivanka Trump, has been handling government business on her own personal email. And the word email should trigger all of our listeners who will remember that, of course, Hillary Clinton was deemed worthy of being locked up by Donald Trump in 2016 for using her personal email or a private server for handling government business.
What you're essentially saying is that to protect his own daughter, Donald Trump was ready to align himself with an authoritarian strongman leader, if you like, in the Middle East. And it does feel as if lots of the examples in the book come back to those relationships with leaders like that, including the president of China. What does Bolton reveal about that relationship?
Well, to me, this is the most shocking aspect of the book, although maybe shocking is the wrong word because that seems to imply some kind of surprise, but it's the most dispiriting, which is Donald Trump meets regularly with Xi Jinping, the leader of China, and John Bolton describes one encounter, and I think it's implied in the writing that the Chinese leader clearly feared American condemnation for the detention centers which China has constructed in Xinjiang province for the 1 million or so mainly Muslim Uyghur population. And Bolton rightly, I think, describes these as, quote, basically concentration camps, unquote.
In the far west of China, evidence is building that a monstrous crime is taking place, the mass incarceration of up to 1 million people. These photographs, found by a Uyghur expert and verified by Human Rights Watch, appear to show hundreds of Muslim prisoners in re-education camps.
And most observers, human rights organizations, consider the existence of these camps a great crime that has been committed. Now, Xi of China clearly fears American condemnation of this, and so tries to make the case explaining why these camps exist. Trump, in Bolton's telling, says he has no problem with these camps, that China should go right ahead and carry on building them because they are, quote, exactly the right thing to do. Now, why that is so awful is that it's the American presidency and therefore the United States of America and its government giving its blessing to this appalling violation of human rights. It'd be bad enough if he wasn't condemning it, bad enough if they were turning a blind eye, but to give the blessing from leader to such a crime is a jaw-dropping mark of the depravity of the Trump administration. But it's all of a piece with the picture Bolton paints, because he wants to ingratiate himself with Xi Jinping simply for his own personal reasons. And even if that means violating what would previously have been an American value to stand against the notion of concentration camps in the modern world. So he tells Xi Jinping on a phone call, I miss you. They meet in the margins of the G20 in Osaka. And that's partly where he makes this remark about the Uyghurs, but also says, apropos of trade talks, you can have a big role in our election. I'm up for re-election in 2020, and I need to win those farm states. So if you, China, increase your purchases of soybeans and wheat, that will help me in those all-important farm states, you know, the likes of Iowa and others in the Midwest. And in return, if you do that for me, I will lower trade tariffs that the United States has imposed on China.
China is going to start spending money even during the negotiation to our farmers, our great farmers in the Midwest. I call them the great patriots, because that's what they are, they're patriots.
Now, just absorb for a minute what that means. He's saying, I'm going to use America's interests on trade and the economy as counters and beans to buy your support for my own partisan election. That was exactly the claim that saw Trump impeached over Ukraine. And what Bolton reveals is that's par for the course. It wasn't just Ukraine. That wasn't a one-off. That's his mode of being with these other leaders, and particularly with dictators.
I mean, as you say, Bolton basically paints the picture of a president almost enamored by these authoritarian leaders, not just in China, but in Russia, Turkey, North Korea. He seems almost desperate to impress them.
That is the pattern that comes all the way through the book, that he not only is not hard line or firm against these dictators, but bends over backwards to give what Bolton calls personal favours to dictators he liked. And so there he is, ingratiating himself with Xi. He does something similar with Erdogan of Turkey.
The president and I have been, we've been very good friends. We've been friends for a long time, almost from day one.
With Vladimir Putin.
President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
So this is the pattern all the way through of kissing up to, groveling to dictators and strongmen, even at the expense of America's national interest, whether it be protecting elections or allowing the judicial process to go through, until you get to the point where, as Bolton puts it, obstruction of justice was a way of life for the Trump presidency. But this groveling takes lurid form in the case of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, who Trump went through this weird volte-face, first having a Twitter spat with him and calling him Rocket Man and mocking him on Twitter. Then he's all over him and they're exchanging what Trump, remember, famously called love letters.
He wrote me beautiful letters, and they're great letters. We fell in love.
I think Kim Jong-un gets a huge laugh out of this. I mean, these letters are written by some functionary in the North Korean Workers' Party agitprop office. And yet the president has looked at him as evidence of this deep friendship.
And as a token of his affection, Donald Trump gets into his head that he must send a gift of Elton John's song Rocket Man personally to Kim Jong-un. And then there's a meeting about, will it violate US sanctions on North Korea for the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, to hand over a CD of this Elton John song. This is madness. It's something out of a kind of dystopian satire. And yet at the center of it is Donald Trump and his unctuous, hand-rubbing urge to ingratiate himself with some of the world's most wicked rulers.
I mean, I am laughing out loud at the description of what you're saying, but this is dangerous, isn't it?
It is. And it's the United States, which, you know, is still the world's most powerful democracy, which for all its hideous inconsistencies and hypocrisies over the decades, still is seen as a democratic standard setter by the rest of the democratic world on freedom of the press and free speech and so on. Here is Donald Trump on his knees, groveling to the head of a slave state in North Korea. Here is Donald Trump giving the green light to modern-day concentration camps in China. Here is Donald Trump refusing even to say to the leader of Russia, you have violated and attempted to meddle in our elections. It is a shaming record, and it's described by somebody who saw it up close.
And one of the things that shines through all of this is this sense that Trump defines America's relations with countries in other parts of the world by his personal relation with a foreign leader. Doesn't it also mean that it's handing a lot of power to those foreign leaders who can get one over on America strategically simply by sucking up to Donald Trump?
Yes, you can feel the kind of wolfish smirk on the face of the likes of Vladimir Putin as they realize how easy it is to get one over the United States, because how easy it is to get one over the United States president. You just have to flatter him. And as long as you give him the illusion that you're helping his re-election effort, you can get away with whatever you like, no matter how badly it costs America and its standing in the world.
I think Putin thinks he can play him like a fiddle. I think he sees that he's not faced with a serious adversary here.
He's easily tricked all the time. And Bolton, I think, plausibly argues he was against the approach to North Korea. That, to me, was obvious at the time, that Kim Jong-un was getting everything and Trump getting nothing. But if somebody is only driven by ego and just wants the optics of a big photographed handshake, you can give him that, it costs you nothing, and you get huge amounts in return.
Donald Trump got a lot. The U.S. itself got nothing from that. The United States gave much more legitimacy to this dictator and didn't accomplish anything toward any meaningful discussion on the elimination of their nuclear weapons program.
Trump is almost, I think, one of the very worst deal makers in international relations that anybody can remember, and Bolton's book confirms it.
And all of that is about self-interest, but what about this claim on stunning ignorance, thinking Finland was a part of Russia, not knowing the UK was a nuclear power? Again, really easy to laugh at that, but isn't an understanding of geopolitics critical when you are leader of one of the most powerful countries in the world?
It really is, and it should be. And those stories are horrifying. And what's interesting about them is how Bolton goes to some lengths to make clear that there was no possibility that this was a joke. You know, that's often a Trump defense. Oh, he was only joking.
It was a comment that he made in jest. It's a comment that he made in passing.
You know, it was tongue-in-cheek.
Did the president...
Come on now. That was tongue-in-cheek. Please.
I don't know that it was tongue-in-cheek at all.
I know it was tongue-in-cheek.
He has said similar things
for
months.
Tongue-in-cheek.
He has said similar things for months.
I don't kid. Let me just tell you. Let me make it clear.
Now, in a way, there is a universe in which perhaps that would be forgivable if you had somebody who'd only been in domestic politics and then came in suddenly as president, if they were aware of their own ignorance and desperate to correct for it and read and learn. But Bolton describes, for example, the briefings, the intelligence briefings, which come down to just twice a week, whereas under previous presidents they were daily, where Trump does all the talking. And instead of listening and absorbing information from the highest grade intelligence agencies you could imagine, he talks over the briefer and starts on long digressions, things he's picked up from friends and Fox News. You know, he is an absolute cliche caricature of a sort of golf club bore who, instead of absorbing in 15 minutes distilled information from agents all over the world, is saying, I heard this wild theory in the 19th hole yesterday, and starts boring on about it. And you can feel Bolton's eyes rolling as he describes this and how he misses the days of the presidents he used to work for who didn't behave like that.
Coming up, John Bolton's claims about Donald Trump's presidency are quite something. But can we trust him? First, I wanted to thank all of you who have voted for us in the British Podcast Awards Listener's Choice category. I see your tweets and it means a lot to the whole team who are getting Today in Focus out remotely every day. If you haven't voted, it only takes a minute. Go to www.bfocus.com britishpodcastawards.com/vote. We really appreciate it. Okay, so you've told us about John Bolton's devastating claims about the president. He is scathing about Trump. He describes a president who is deeply ignorant, highly incompetent, and who is consumed by dangerous self-interest. And all this from a man who, as you say, was very much in the room and saw all of it happen. But to take John Bolton's account seriously, we have to trust him. And I guess my next question is, should we?
I found myself not particularly liking John Bolton as a narrator through the book, but I do think he is reliable. One thing is that Bolton was a notorious note taker in Washington. This was known before, you know, with the yellow legal pads. He scribbles throughout meetings. And the book has enough detail in it that you think, yeah, you wouldn't write that unless you absolutely had noted the detail at the time. The other thing is that Donald Trump has said, one of the reasons when he was trying to fight the book, that it contains classified information. Well, if a book is made up, if things in it are lies, they can't be classified. There's no such thing as a classified lie. So Donald Trump himself, inadvertently, in trying to block the book, vouched for it.
Okay, but if we can trust most of these really quite important claims, why is John Bolton being criticised so harshly for the way in which he's revealed them?
Well, that's the interesting twist in the tale here, because you would think that the people who despise Donald Trump would now be rallying round and embracing John Bolton as a kind of heroic teller of truths. That hasn't happened with John Bolton. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think the first one is that Bolton has such a record in terms of his warmongery that it's just a bridge too far for many liberals to suddenly make John Bolton a pinup. But then the other reason is simply about the timing. And here, the very strength of the book works to undermine one's opinion of Bolton himself, because the revelations are so strong, the weight of evidence is so copious, that you then find yourself, as you're reading the book, less angry with Trump because you know he's a venal, vile authoritarian, but with Bolton because you're thinking, why didn't you say this earlier? And that is particularly sharp when it comes to the point about impeachment, because the Democrats in the House did ask John Bolton to come and testify. He had left the administration by then. He didn't go, and that's partly because the White House was saying to all former employees, you can't come. But it was a choice that Bolton made. Now, imagine if you're Bolton, you're watching the Democrats pursue this case on impeachment, and you know, and only you know, that not only is all the Ukraine stuff true, but it was just one of several examples. And if you went up to Capitol Hill and opened up your files, you could tell them, look, he didn't just do it with Ukraine, he did it with China. Now, who knows whether that would have been enough to undo Donald Trump in the eyes of those Republicans who are ready to forgive Trump everything if it helps them save their skin. But the point is, Bolton never even tried. He said instead, I'll testify if the Senate asks me. Well, the Senate has a Republican majority. That was almost certainly never going to happen. And so the reading that becomes very enticing is Bolton held on to this stuff because he wanted a $2 million book deal, which he's now got, rather than doing what was best for the country. And so the irony is the very thing he accuses Donald Trump of, which is putting his personal interest before the interest of the United States, he himself is guilty of that. If he'd been motivated by the national interest, he would have blown this whistle.
Donald Trump says that John Bolton is a disgruntled, boring fool, a wacko, incompetent. He calls him a dope who never had a clue, who was ostracized and happily dumped. Is he saying that because he is worried that these revelations could be extremely damaging to his presidency?
Well, he always says that to people who turn on him. He's done it with Tillerson and Mattis and now Bolton. Of course, it doesn't reflect very well on his ability to pick talent. He is worried by the Bolton book, I'm sure. Whether or not he should be worried is an interesting question. I think it probably would have done much more damage to him. It would have been much more dramatic if he had come and said this during the impeachment. Maybe it would never have made a difference. And maybe even now, this won't make a difference. Partly because it simply confirms, albeit at a much higher level, everything we already knew about Trump. He is as ignorant, as self-centered, and as abusive of America's constitution and values in private as he is in public. So maybe it doesn't move the needle that much. That said, the political climate is what's moving against Donald Trump, both the coronavirus pandemic and the economic downturn that's linked to it. And so anything at the moment that adds to this impression, as the polls slide for Donald Trump, that he is not fit for the job, and that even arch-conservatives and arch-Republicans are saying it, maybe that does open the door for some Republican voters who stayed loyal until now to finally realise enough is enough.
Jonathan Friedland, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Friedland. Do read his column on John Bolton's book at theguardian.com and all the reporting on this from our teams at Guardian US. If you follow me on Twitter at Anushka Astana, I'll post some interesting articles to read alongside this podcast. Now, you might remember we did a call out a while back for stories from our listeners for a new podcast. Well, it is finally here. It's called Innermost, and it's about strangers and their secret lives. You know that feeling you get when you overhear a conversation in the street and you're left wondering what it was about? This is presented by the brilliant Leia Green, who lets you listen in on the whole story. It's really enticing, and it's out now. Search for Innermost wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's all for today. My thanks to Jonathan Friedland. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.